This is another edition of Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk, and there's more at the website, allbook-books.com. There's part two of Jessica Hernandez's Fresh Banana Leaves, Healing Indigenous Landscapes Through Indigenous Science, published by North Atlantic Books. I'm going to flip through and read some of my highlight sections. This is in the chapter Tierra Madre, Indigenous Women and Ecofeminism. Basic Spanish, but Tierra Madre is Earth Mother or Mother Earth. And this is recording outside in case you hear any random noises and bird calls and such like. And she writes, despite everything Indigenous women continue to face in their communities due to settler colonial violence, they work hard toward their existence, resistance, and resilience. My grandmother always shared with me that through our, I don't know how to pronounce it, HUIPILES, we are also able to share the stories that negatively impact us because that is the reality of Indigenous peoples. Actually, checking the index, it is the, it's some kind of clothing. When you wear a huipil, you are wearing a part of nature. This is how you make your beautiful ancestral homes of Oaxaca everywhere you go. Through our huipiles, however you pronounce that, we weave together our landscapes and plant relatives. For the Zapotec community, flowers are important symbols because Oaxaca is one of the regions that has a high flora biodiversity. A good mention of those and how they are taught to do the weavings, and that wherever they are, that those weavings help carry the culture, especially the flowers and the plant life, that aspect and their connection with all that. Without managing our environments, capitalism and extractive natural resource methods continue to harm our environments. In the community of Santiago, something part of the Zapotec Nation, over 300 comuneras, indigenous communal environmental stewards, are applying community-based forest management to ensure that they not only protect their forests from illegal logging and deforestation, but also protect their livelihoods. Back to the, my grandmother always shared with me that through our floral designs on the clothing, we are also able to share the, whatever that word is, we are also able to share the stories that negatively impact us because that is the reality of Indigenous peoples. We are able to find the positive in everything, and despite facing violent atrocities committed by the Mexican military or government against us, our huipiles are a way we can also escape our harsh realities and seek nature and our environment as a refuge. She told me that sometimes this was why we focused on expressing our feelings and entire selves in the artwork by integrating part of our environments, because this served as our own sanctuary. It reminds me of my father's story, as he also sought nature and his environment as a sanctuary during war. So this again reminds me of the difference in the cultures, and you know, for many of us, just going out, taking a walk, go on the trail, take a little hike, you know, in suburbia or wherever, it's nice. And then there are people for which, you know, the deep connection with nature is much more, the ability to connect with nature is not that simple because of the system of capitalism and extractivism and such like. And here she talks about other creativity. Beatrice showed how her grandmothers were able to express themselves in their textiles. Beatrice was missing this in her educational career, as writing in Western academia is more rigid, dictates a certain structure, and is limited on the expressiveness one can share. I have found in my own experiences that books are the only method of writing that can allow us as scientists and academics to express our thoughts and stories. Unlike peer-reviewed articles, which mandate that we write in third person and follow a linear structure, books can be tailored more to Indigenous ways of knowing and teaching. Like our textiles, writing books about our own stories is a way we can express ourselves. And the textiles obviously have, she mentions, the visual element. So this, as I mentioned in part one, a very positive aspect of books. And also, I find interesting because as a writer who writes in various genres, that she says that the academic papers, you know, do not allow, they have to write in third person and follow a linear structure, peer-reviewed articles. So, you know, the different, to me, it's always like, whatever gets the message out there. I don't care if it's a joke, it's a poem, it's a quote, it's a book, it's a story, whatever it is, it's an essay. To me, it's what venue is gonna presumably best get the message out there. And then a very interesting bit of the languages, the CODICES, is CODICES, that could be a whole study, but indigenous women are deeply connected to their environments, and despite sometimes not being offered the opportunity to learn how to read or write colonial languages that govern their current countries, they can express themselves visually. For me, being able to represent ourselves visually is similar to the ancient writing our ancestors practiced through codices. Their writing system was made up of figures and symbols, not letters, like we have now integrated into many languages. That's another significant bit to realize that the languages that go way back are not based on letters. The letters were essentially, you know, from Phoenician and the Semites and others, they were basically became like a commodity that was shipped. The letters got on the boats with the consciousness, and the boats went around, and people started sharing the letters, and the letters became the language. So it's really an underrated, under-realized, not as understood aspect. People talk about commerce and colonialism and, you know, globalism and all these things, but the language, the letters came across the waters as well. Because if you think about it, then the indigenous cultures have these ancient languages that go way back, and they apply to the regions where they're at. The people in the Arctic, the Inuit, have umpteen words for snow. And the Lakota have umpteen words for clouds. And the Japanese in haiku territory, the Japanese have like umpteen words for cherry blossoms and the petals. And also, as I learned from a Kanaka Maoli, aka Native Hawaiian friend, there are many types of rain. So it's fascinating how every people of every region, their language is shaped by the weather and the land and such like. So the languages as place-based, this is like things have been turned upside down, because the letters and the language that then turned into English and became the global standard, that is part of that whole vehicle of colonialism that travels. So then the language and the consciousness becomes a language, among other things, of that sense of traveling, which is connected to commerce, very much connected to commerce and the government and the domination that comes with that. So as Native people accentuate, and I've heard it so many times, how important the languages are. It's not just the language of being able to write and speak, it's the connection with the land and the ability to care for the land, and that it represents a whole peoples, not just some generic globalized communication. And also the book reminds, you know, you read stuff in the news and then you kind of forget about it, but then once in a while I pick up a book and I'm like, oh yeah, somebody mentions what happened and what the effects are, that some hurricane blew through some area, and then it's in the news, and then we forget about it. But that's ongoing. The aftermath of that is ongoing. So she writes in the chapter Ancestral Foods, Hurricanes in Central America. Hurricanes Ida and Iota devastated many Central American countries like Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Belize from October to November 2020. Many of our indigenous communities in Central America live near or are in proximity to rivers, and with the heavy rains, hurricanes Eta and Iota brought, the rivers were flooded. This flooding destroyed many homes and everything many families owned. The indigenous communities who resided at higher altitudes experienced landslides that also destroyed their homes and caused everything that these landslides came in contact with to vanish. These landslides and other environmental impacts caused by hurricanes blocked many roads, making it difficult to bring any aid to the indigenous communities most impacted. The government was also was always absent, and no aid was ever provided to our communities, so many people had to become resourceful and seek aid elsewhere. Oftentimes, when media outlets cover hurricanes, they focus more on home and shelter destruction, but rarely mention the agricultural losses. So again, the different aspects of what kind of information we get and what pictures we get. And she again mentions in a section called Land Back that self-sufficiency is very important, as government entities never provide any support or aid to our communities. Never. And that is why this also allows, why the importance of ceremonies at our ancestral and sacred sites. That's obvious importance. And she writes, in indigenizing conservation, as I mentioned in this book, we face the highest ecological debt, yet those who are responsible for what the climate change our planet is undergoing continue to profit and benefit from settler colonialism. So yet another imbalance. And this is a woman she's interviewing who has an organization called the Mayan League, Juanita Cabrera Lopez. And I'm gonna read a couple of those bits. One that pertains to the book title, when we say healing our indigenous landscapes, what does that mean to the indigenous peoples from Central America being forced to flee their ancestral lands? Part of that answer is, healing is really about reconnecting with and becoming connected with the land wherever you are, having respect for and how to care for the land and our environment, and giving things. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in all the ways that the proper ancestral ceremonies are, because maybe we can't do that, but we put our tobacco down, or we offer a prayer by the water, or we have a place in our home for an altar and reflection. I think there's a lot of process right now in taking away the layers of self-preservation, decolonizing, where we have publicly denied our identity because we have often been killed because of our identity. Part I like about that is that she says it's not always, sometimes natives are seen, indigenous people are seen as just doing like, oh, that's the same old ritual that they've done for hundreds of thousands and thousands of years, but they're adaptable and they keep up with the times. So there she expresses how you may not be always able to do the exact thing that was done then, but you do what you can. And here's a question, how is the border crisis an environmental and climate justice issue? Another question answered by the Mayan League woman. This border crisis is a process of colonization and the imposition of borders that has been occurring for more than 500 years. With the creation of nations and states that were violently placed on our ancestral lands through slavery, through killing, through rape, through these very violent processes that never recognized us and only saw our lands and us as commodities, we have been forced to migrate. And so, when you have a model already settled over our ancestral lands and territories, not just the Maya, but all across Abya Yala, that is Central America, but all across Abya Yala and really across the world, and how this imposition of Western-based models and colonial structures continue to degrade our natural resources to the point that there is no more resources for us indigenous peoples, original stewards of the lands, we are forced to migrate. What we continue to see today is a legacy of colonization. What happened with the Maya communities was the model of the government and the state. Side note, that's called fascism. Government and the state that was created to further policies and create a plan for a small elite, settlers and white people. So everything that was created was to perpetuate control of economic structures of land, of wealth, within a small minority that were not from our lands originally. Even today, there is a lack of legal recognition of our lands and territories, or the very best lands are in the hands of a minority. What that ends up meaning is that when people ask, if climate change is happening, why can't indigenous people start going to traditional agriculture or traditional ways? My response has been, on what land? When all of our lands have been taken from us, where are we supposed to go? I think there's a lack of awareness of the intrinsic way to in which indigenous peoples and our particular relationship with our lands and territories are not understood. Now that's a very emotional bit, and it's sad to read that these indigenous peoples that have this ancient knowledge, but there's a lack of land to do that. That is the actual genuine loss that is happening. And I mean, it's not the same thing, but the other day driving to the supermarket, I saw in an area already built up, I saw another little patch of trees knocked down for another little office complex or stores or whatever it is they're putting in. So even though that's not the same as the loss of indigenous land for their culture, to my understanding, it is the same mentality. It's the same, again, letters-based language that is perpetuating that kind of thinking, because it's all connected, as Hernandez mentions in the book. It's all connected: the land, the culture, the fruits, the vegetables, everything, and the languages. So again, as I mentioned in part one, it's a very informational book. It's a very emotional book, because people just, she and the quotes that she provides, people just, they just tell the truth and what's going on and how they feel. And as she says, they always keep a look at the positive. And yet emotionally, when I read this stuff, I realize how much troubling stuff there is to deal with. And later on, she talks about healing. Slavery stole the indigeneity of the black community and indigenous peoples without negating the existence and identity of black natives or Afro-indigenous peoples. As you mentioned, healing hurts, and everyone experiences healing differently. But as indigenous peoples, we must make space for all indigenous peoples, whether they are from the Americas or are descendants of slavery, to heal and join us in our healing circles. I personally believe black people, descendants of slavery in the Americas, are neither settlers or allies, but are indigenous peoples who were forcefully displaced from their ancestral lands because of slavery. They were enslaved because they already held to that ancestral knowledge of caring and stewarding the land. And I will continue to include them in my discourses around indigeneity, despite the opposition I will continue to receive even from other indigenous colleagues and community members. That's also a very powerful allyship aspect of that. And that's another book I mention frequently, Tom Burgess, The Looting Machine, about Africa. And again, I applaud her courage to speak up in her various milieus. Here she writes, how Latin American countries were also created through genocide and slavery needs to be acknowledged as well. These tend to be very uncomfortable conversations for those who benefit from whiteness in Latin America, and for us indigenous peoples as well, because when we question the dominant narratives and movements, we receive a lot of pushback and witness a lot of white fragility and guilt that is projected on those most marginalized under the whiteness in the United States and Latin America. There are levels of oppression within the Latino discourse and movement that objectify indigenous peoples and indigenous women because of our beautiful clothing and how we celebrate who we are. Settler colonialism taught us that as indigenous peoples, we were not created equal, despite the Americas being our ancestral homelands. In the environmental justice movement, we must reflect on who are the voices left out from platforms, from the advocacy we continue to lead, and the recognition that is not granted to those who have been doing this kind of work for generations. Like an onion planted on the ground, a new layer grew on me, and this was the layer of needing to cite our lived experience, ways of knowing, and my life experience. Now, here's also a fascinating bit in the book about tears. Decolonization is something allies can support but not co-opt. This is an ongoing effort that will hurt and make us cry, but like peeling onions, yeah, the crow likes that, but like peeling onions, our tears will help us heal. The tears we shed will be the tears from our ancestors as they endured harder times, and many of them gave the ultimate sacrifice, their lives. To ensure our cultures did not disappear, my grandmother always told me that when she left this world, my tears would be her way of speaking to me, because this is how our ancestors communicate with us. Since tears have healing properties, which Western science has also concluded to be true, our ancestors communicate through us in our tears, because when we are healing, they are also healing. So that has a footnote. The healing effects of crying from holistic nursing practice. By the last name, Fooladi, from 2005. So that's amongst the wonderful little vignette. That is amazing scientific tidbits. Since tears have healing properties, which Western science has concluded to be true. So that's one aspect of how this blend of Western science and indigenous awareness and wiseness can help each other. And as she ends the book, community makes space and room for us to grow, continue learning, and embrace our flaws. This is part of the healing process we have to embrace and make room for. So both the land and community are essential aspects of healing. When we heal ourselves, we heal landscapes, and it is time we create space for Indigenous peoples to heal as we move forward in life. Community makes space and room for us to grow, continue learning, and embrace our flaws. This is part of the healing process we have to embrace and make room for. So I tried to fit in one more aspect of the book that I wanted to add some commentary on. And somehow, mysteriously, the gadget glitched, so it only recorded part of it. So I figured either I'm not supposed to say that stuff, or I'm supposed to say it and give it more emphasis, because I do have more to say about it. So I'm going to make that a part three about the book, which, to give you a clue, she mentions the Zapotec having three genders. That's it, folks, three genders. So I want to talk about that as the simplicity of that in context with the modern confusion. So that'll be a part three. So, but otherwise, it's, again, it's a fascinating book conveying the Indigenous perspective as a novel would convey it through the eyes of the main character. In some formats, this gives you a perspective of one woman, only one woman, reflecting many, many facets of Indigenous perspective, and yet hers is common to others that I have heard, and also she reflects the community, so it's her personal experience as well as her community and her peoples, and being a voice for the land. So a good summer read, I would suggest it. A lot of information, a lot of emotion, and just raw honesty. So thanks for listening, and be well.